Good evening. It's good to see everyone. Thank you as joining for all of
you. Miss everybody.
And if you do have something to share, please please do unmute and share. Okay, so the topic of our discussion tonight is, I think, a really, really important and fundamental one. And that is the topic of Tzelem Elokim, the notion of the image of God. And we hear often in many contexts this notion that, look, humans are created in the image of God, therefore we have to treat each one respectfully, no matter who they are. You hear it in various contexts. And the question is, what do we mean when we say the image of God? What exactly does it refer to? So before I begin and show you some of the opinions on that, I'd like to hear what you think. Just, you know, Tzelem, in terms of define the word Tzelem. Tzelem, often we think of an image or a statue of some sort, an icon. Like, we think of bowing down to a Tzelem is something we don't do. We usually translate that as an idol. So clearly it means that people have some sort of resemblance in some way to God. And that's really important. That means that they're very valuable. We have existential value. We have to respect everyone. So what do you think? What do you think it means? Just off the cuff. Any guesses or thoughts?
Don't you have to define what God is first?
Well, that's quite a okay. Let's call God the cause of all existence, the omnipotent, omniscient, perfect cause of all existence. Let's say that.
Well, you could say the man has a mind. Man can think. Man has free will.
Man can think. Okay, we'll get to that. So Paul says man can think. That's a really important opinion that we'll talk about. So my question would be, why does that mean we need to respect them? That's my question. Like, okay, so humans are created in the image of God, which means humans can think, we can analyze, we can, you know, we have the power of cognition, we can use our mind to do amazing things. Why does that mean that you know, I have to respect someone? And then let me ask another question. Say someone has lost their ability to think rationally, or say we're talking about a child who doesn't think so thoroughly and hasn't quite mastered their powers of their intellect.
But humankind has the ability to make choices, to think and make choices. And you can choose good or you can choose evil. You have the right. You have the ability. You have the creativity.
That's okay. The word.
The creativity.
Creativity to me, that was the word I was going to throw in.
Like
there.
The word creative. Because that makes
I don't
a lot of
see
sense.
How animals can be creative, because they're sort of like programmed to already do what it is that they do and survive, whereas humans can change their environment. We can build things that change our whole environment. We can take wheat and turn it into bread. Like, there's no animal that can do that.
Right. So that's where Soloveitchik actually says. And I think it makes sense in context. It's really important. So I actually, all these ideas are really great, and they're all in the sources. But I want to, let's explore now. So the first thing I want to show you is that this question of what Tzelem Elokim is isn't just a question of defining an important term. It's actually, I would argue that the Rishonim, the Achronim, the rabbis throughout generations, scholars throughout generations, have seen this as the most important defining quality of humanity. That defining Tzelem Elokim defines what makes humans human. And I want to show that. But I think they're getting that, I think, from the Torah itself. So let's put the slideshow right now. Here we go. Okay, just 1 second. Let me hit the slideshow. And from the beginning. Okay, beautiful. So let's take a look at some psukim we've heard already many times. And they're difficult psukim. I want to actually try to at least present some approaches to difficulties now. So now we're talking about in the very first paragraph in Bereishit, where the Torah describes Hashem creating humans. And God talks about this idea, as we discussed in the past, as follows. It says, "Vayomer Elokim naaseh adam b'tzalminu kidmutinu." So God says, "Naase Adam, let us make man, bitzalmenu kidmutenu." I'm not going to translate those words yet. Salmimu means an hour tselem. Mutenu means an hour demut. Notice already that there's two terms here. I think that's worth noting. We don't always say, we always talk about tselem elokim. We don't always talk about demut elokim. But they're both used here. And it's just worth noting that when God thinks of making man, he doesn't just say na'aseh adam. He says bitzalmenu kimutenu. This is something really important about humans. They have tselem and demut. So that's in terms of his thought process. Then we go to psukim later. And it says, but actually, let me continue. And the next part of the verse is what we've talked about in the weeks past. But yirdu begad hayam ve'of hashamayim ba'avema v'chol ha'aretz v'chol remes v'meis ha'aretz. So we're going to make man in our image. And, you know, b'tzbutenu b'tzalminu. And they're going to rule, and we discussed the ramifications of that authority over all the other animals in the world. And it happens. Vayivra elokim et adam b'tzalmo, b'tzalm elokim bara oto. Right? Think about that. It's almost like the Torah is like obsessed with this. God created man in his image, b'tzalm elokim bara oto. He created him in the image of God. Now I'm using the term image, which is not necessarily what the term that you should use. Zachar ekeva bara oto. He created them male and female. Beautiful. My question now would be as follows. There are a number of questions you could ask in this pasuk, but I just want to get to the obvious point here. In this context, what would you say that tselem elokim would mean? Just from the context, right? Like in the context of creation, you know, creating everything, when God says, let us make man in our image, what would it mean?
Well, it's referring to a body, but also to a type of body that can rule over animals. So it's referring to some sort of brain power that's unique as well, not just physical strength.
Kind of makes a great point. So you see in this context, number one, that something, and I don't know if this is the only point of tselem elokim, but something about tselem elokim enables humans to rule over the other creations in the world. Dinosaurs are authority.
Did man rule over dinosaurs?
Dinosaurs, maybe the dinosaurs, I don't know.
Can I just point out that there's a real big problem with that first sentence. When it says, let us make, who is God talking to?
So that's the big question.
Okay, and so I just want to point out, if he's talking to his angels, then that's where you get the idea that angels are running around in human form. Because when we think of angels,
right,
the Christian idea, and also the story of course, Abraham later, when the three angels come to him, is if we're made in angel's image, then angels look like us too. Angels
right.
look like men, because we're made in the image of the angels. He said, let us make man in our image.
So right, the hour is a big problem. 100%. So now I'll make two really important points. I think you're making two points that are both, I think there are two problems with the phrase. So the word hour is a big problem. Let us make man is a big problem. This is obviously something that needs some sort of explanation. And there are, I think, three generally. I'll mention them briefly now. One is that na'aseh refers to the angels, as Dalia mentioned. The other one is that it actually refers to the earth. And then the third is that it's an expression. There are a few times in the Torah where God talks in plural. Migdal Babel as well. When we talk about the Torah, the Tower of Babel, God says, let us go down. And I think sometimes even in, and I'm not saying this is that God has talked this way too, but sometimes we use the word we. Like I just said, we use the word we. But like, what do I mean by we? You know, or like an author will say, as we've already written in this treatise. But the we is just, there's only one author, right? So sometimes people use the term we to be like inclusive in a sense. But I think it's an important question, though, to grapple with. And I want to get back to it. There's another point, though, which is the image idea. Image. Image is usually something that we see, that's tangible, that you can identify very specifically. And associating image with God is a problematic notion if we believe in an infinite God. That's another thing that we have to define. And the question would be, what are demut, and what's the difference between demut and tselem? Right, there's two terms here. Now, I want to point out now that both of them are very important. So number one, let's take a look at the next time we say this. So at this, if you look at our second selection here. This is after the story of Bereshit, after the story of Adam and Chava, after the story of Cain and Hevel. We have a bit of a wrap-up of the first parsha in the Torah, Bereshit, and it goes to the generations from Adam to Noah. And it begins that detailing of the generations with the following two psukim. It says, Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam. This is the book of the lineage of Adam. Biyom Vero Elokim Adam. When God created man, Bidmut Elokim Asa'ota. He made him Bidmut Elokim. I'm not going to define Bidmut yet. Zachar Nekev Avraham, and he created them male and female. Ve'varech Latam Ve'krat Shemam Adam B'yom Hibara. Just notice here that, I think this is just so telling how important this is. What the Torah is doing here is simply mentioning the generations from Adam until Noah. And yet it can help, but mention, like if you're going to mention that God created man, you have to say, he created him with Mut Elohim. You can't mention the creation of man in the Torah without also pointing out that it's been Mut Elohim. So I think you see how fundamental it is. It's all like this didn't need to be mentioned. It could have just said Zeber Tolod Adam, and then gone on to mention that he created man, and these were his children, these are his progeny. It doesn't need to mention. We already know, but that it's been Mut Elohim. So that's the second point where we see this notion of how important it is that it's been Mut Elohim. Aside from the fact that it's just a very, you know, you hear that statement, it's quite jarring. What do you mean we're made in the image of God or whatever the image is? Fine. Then we move to a third mentioning of this concept. And here we have Salam Elohim again. And what is the context of this? This is in the story of Noah. So this is after Noah builds the Teva and invites all creation onto the Teva and gets the marble. He's on there for 4 days and 40 nights. And he, after the waters dissipate and the land becomes dry, he leaves the Teva. And this is God's speech to Noah after they leave. And it says as follows. It's worth looking at the context here to appreciate what Salam Elohim is, how it's operating here. So God blesses Noah and his children. Be fruitful and multiply and fill up the land. By the way, you know, God told that to Adam HaRishon. Why do you think he might mention again to Noah that he should be fruitful and multiply and populate the land? Why might that be necessary? What do you think? Well, there's no more people on the land. He just wiped out the entirety of humanity, as the Torah tells it. So then it's important to reiterate, okay, now we need more people. Fine. So now what's important to note is that God reshapes the relationship between humans and animals in these next few verses. Your fear and your dread will be upon all the wild animals. It says, the animals are going to be afraid of you. There's going to be a fear, a dread of humans. Anything that crawls, that lives, is yours to eat. You can eat them, just like the grass. Ah, basar b'nasho demol tochelu. However, even though I let you eat the animals, you shouldn't eat them while they're alive. That's a simple way to explain that. We don't eat live animals, we kill them first. And Noah wasn't able to do that. V'ach et dimchem b'nasho shechem en rosh miyal kol chiyar mishenim. And your blood for your souls I will seek from any wild animal. Miyad ha'adam, miyad ish achiv, and rosh nefesh ha'adam. And I will seek the blood from any man, and the blood of a man from his brother, I will seek the soul of man. So basically, don't you dare, even though I'm allowing you to kill animals, but don't you dare kill each other. And if you do, then I'm gonna seek you out. I'm gonna take vengeance for that person. And then we have the next line. Let me just finish this point. Shofek dam ha'adam ba'adam demoi shofek. A person who spoils the blood of a man in a ba'adam or by man, his blood shall be spilled. Ki b'tselem elokim asa et ha'adam. Because and quote unquote, we'll say the image of God, he made man. So in this pasuk, what is B'Tzemer Elokim doing? Why do we invoke this notion of the image of God? What is it explaining? You can't, if you spill the blood of man, your blood will be spilled. Why? Ki B'Tzelem Elokim asah et Adam. What's it telling you? Why can't you do that? You can't murder. You can't hunt humans. The reasoning is, the reason you can't kill another human is because they're made B'Tzelem Elokim. That this notion of the image of God is a reason, is the most fundamental idea that the Torah can think of to explain why their life matters. Why you can't decide at your leisure to kill someone else. Because they're made in the image of God. That's very fundamental. That's saying this is why people's lives have value. Because they're made in the image of God. So you see, this is a very important idea. Again, almost in the context, we kill animals, right? That's the Torah saying here for the first time. You can kill animals. You can hunt. If you're in your house and there's a bug or an insect that intimidates you, or you find it grotesque, or you think it's getting your food, so you would kill that sometimes. But you can't do that to a human because humans are made in the image of God. This, to me, shows that this is a big deal, that the image of God is very important. And then the question is, what is it? What do we mean? What is this quality that the Torah is discussing such that it's so important that this is the reason, this is the argument for the value of human life? So, Paul, do you want us to share something?
I was just going to ask, why can't I eat trees then?
Eat trees?
Every creature that lives shall be yours to eat.
You can eat trees. This is before the Torah was given.
I eat trees.
Trafe.
Oh, trafe. Well, this is before the Torah was given. This is to Noah. If you're just a Ben Noah, Noah could eat trafe.
This is what God's saying. You're telling me
he's saying it to Noah, right? He's saying it to Noah. Afterward, there was a Jewish people.
Noah and his boys are the only ones around. No one else around.
And God gave a Torah, and there were new laws. That's all. Okay.
Sammy.
Yes. Yes, Sammy. Andrew. Good to see you.
On the previous slide that you had, this concept of the fear and the dread of you, it seems so inconsistent with Noah and his family having spent the time with the beasts,
right,
in the ark. What was the what happened here? What was there's some kind of transition here of some sort to go from cohabiting to fear,
100%.
From taking care of the animals.
I think you're right on target with that, and I think that there's more to say about this. There's a shift here in the relationship between humans and animals, and that happens after Noah leaves the table and lets the animals go, and two things happen simultaneously. I don't think it's a coincidence. Number one, humans are allowed to consume animals. We're allowed to kill them and eat them. And number two, they're afraid of us. And I think those go together. I think that you're right. I think originally we had this role of almost steward of the entire world where we had to take care of the animals. And that sort of symbolized the epitome of that is Noah taking all the animals into the table and saving them. But after that happens, and I don't know, is it because we failed on the whole that humans were too animal-like? Why that is a good question. But it sounds like after Noach leaves the table, we lose that role. And that's what allows us to now hunt them. And that's what also is the reason that there's this dread between man and animal. So I think your point is 100% on.
So, and did this fear exist before the flood?
I think you could argue that it didn't. I'm not sure, but I think you could argue that it didn't.
And
again,
more on point of what you're emphasizing here. What there's this concept of the image of God, but how is blood connected to the image?
So I don't think it is. I think there's two separate points here. One is that maybe not totally separate. There's this notion of nefesh that we find in the Torah that, that there's almost like, there's like the life source is a nefesh, and the blood is emblematic of the basic life source of life in the world. But then beyond that, which humans share with animals, we all have, right? You can't eat animal blood either because of that. It's almost like representative of the basic life source you have to have respect for. But beyond the basic life that all life shares, there's also Tselem Elokim. And if you kill someone, you have to know that, meaning, right, I guess what I respond is, we shed animals' blood. If it was just about the blood, then it shouldn't be necessarily so horrific to hunt humans. But there's more than just the blood. There's Tselem Elokim. Okay? But now we have to define that. What might that mean? So let's go through a few of the... So what I'm going to argue that now is that what I think you see is that the way that you look at Tselem Elokim is also emblematic of what you think is the most important arena of human achievement. What you think is the most important area where humans need to perfect is going to flow from your understanding of what does it mean that we're created with Tselem Elokim. So the first approach is something that Paul mentioned before, and that is it's the cognitive abilities of mankind. That's what Tselem Elokim means. That it doesn't mean image, by the way. It's not a tselem in the sense that, and we have to go back to the we question. Liam has pointed out, we have to go back to what it means that we made man versus I made man. That's still, but in terms of the word tselem, so tselem doesn't necessarily mean image, it might mean form. It might mean likeness. And that tselem Elokim represents the fact that God is the ultimate intellect. In, on our level, that he has complete knowledge, and you know, his knowledge is existence, and through his knowledge things came to exist. And humans also have a divine nature to them, and that they also can use their mind, their knowledge, to think and analyze, to solve problems. And that's what it means, Bitzalminu. And obviously the contrast then is that the other beings in the world don't have that. That even though other life forms in this world certainly do have some sort of cognizance, it's not comparable to the human capability to think. This is what Rabbeinu Bahai says in this source here very succinctly. Bitzalmo, what is Bitzalmo? Rabbeinu Bahai Menasher, one of the Rishonim in the 13th century, or 14th century actually.
So Sammy.
Let me just get the outline here. And he says as follows. Bitzalmo, inyan selam hasagasichli. What's selam? What does it mean? Hasagasichli, it means intellectual capacity. Akavana ba'omro b'tzalminu, l'fisha nefesh ha-sichlit sheba'adam atzula b'rakacha. That the soul, the intellectual soul in a person emanates from God's Holy Spirit. And then in that sense, it's Tselem Elokim, that it's godlike, that it came from God, this intellectual capacity that we have. Let me just show you how the Rambam emphasizes this, and I'll take your point, Andrew. The Rambam, first of all, this is actually, believe it or not, the opening of the Rambam, right? The Rambam wrote this book called The Guide for the Perplexed, which is a philosophical work on Tanakh. And the first thing that he does is he tries to address the anthropomorphisms in the Torah, meaning all the times in the Torah where the Torah seems to attribute physical characteristics to Hashem, the Rambam needs to figure out a way that it's not what it really means. He can't tolerate that based on his philosophical worldview. God has no physical attributes or human-like characteristics. So it's not, it's just a mashal. And here, he tries to explain how Tselem doesn't actually mean the image. When people tell you it's the image of God, it's wrong. It doesn't mean image. It means something else. The term of the Tselem, this is Friedlander's translation, the term Tselem, on the other hand, signifies a specific form, meaning that which constitutes the essence of a thing, whereby the thing is what it is, the reality of a thing insofar as it is that particular being, basically what makes something unique. Its end is tselem. In man, the form is that constituent which gives him human perception, and on account of this intellectual perception, the term tselem is employed, and the sentence is that tselem of God, he created him. Right? Tselem means intellect. That's what it means. And that in a certain sense, it can be said that God has an intellect, and that's in man, our form, what makes us who we are is the intellect. And it's based on this, the Rambam, if you look in the Rambam, if you ask the Rambam, what is the height of human achievement, right? What is the human who has accomplished the most? The pinnacle of what a human can do. So, which is a really interesting question to ask. Like, if you would ask a person, like, what does the best person you could be look like, right? And the Rambam would tell you, intellectual perfection. Someone who has mastered and acquired all knowledge, certainly knowledge of God, and then all the knowledge that flows from that. And here the Rambam writes this in a very forceful way. Here the Rambam is an introduction to the Mishnah. The Rambam wrote a commentary on the entirety of Mishnah, right? The primary source of our tradition, of oral law. And in that commentary, writes as follows. For it cannot be that the purpose of a man is to eat or drink or have relations or to build a house or to be a king. For all of these experiences pass over him and do not add to his essence. Moreover, all these actions are common to him and the other species of animals. And it is knowledge that adds to his essence and advances it from a state to state, from low state to a sublime state, such that he was originally a man in potential and became an actual man. That in order to fully be human, you need to acquire knowledge. And that before you acquire knowledge, in the Rambam's perception, you're not fully human. For man before learning is like an animal. Right? So the Rambam, based on his perception of Tzelem Elokim, argues that it's about the intellect. It's about achieving in the world of the mind. It's about knowing as much as you can, thinking as much as you can. That's the Rambam's take on this. Right, and then Tzelem obviously then isn't about any image. It's just form. It's about the essence of a thing. So my question now to you is: does this satisfy you? Seeing what we've seen, right, about Tzelem, how important Tzelem is, how fundamental it is, and we'll go back to the slides in a second. Seeing how it's the reason you can't kill someone because they're creating the image of God. Now the Rambam is telling you that what Tzelem Elokim means is the fact that we have cognition. We can think, analyze, and acquire knowledge. Does that notion satisfy you, that that's what makes us special or unique or have existential value? What do you think? Who's satisfied? Raise your hand. Who's satisfied with the notion that Tzelem Elokim simply means our ability to think? So no one's raising their head. So who's not
Sammy, satisfied? Sammy, can I ask a question now?
Yeah, sure.
So I'm wondering, based on what you were reading with regards to talking about the image of God,
right,
and the restriction because of that, what form or what state was Adam and Chava in before eating from the tree of knowledge?
Ah, so this is the question, which we'll have to get to when we study the story, and it's especially relevant to our next explanation. But this is a question the Rambam himself asks in the Guides to the Perplexed. What Andrew asks is, if it's indeed true that Adam and Eve were created in the image of God, which means that they had an intellectual and cognitive capacity to think and make decisions, but we're also told they ate from the tree of knowledge, the knowledge of good and evil, which sounds like they only acquire that knowledge of good and evil after they eat from the tree. Which is problematic in a number of ways. Number one, then what were they created with? Number two, why was it a sin? Because wouldn't you want knowledge between good and evil? Isn't that something that we should try to get? Why does God tell us not to eat from it then? In fact, based on that, the snake seems pretty correct, right? What does the snake tell Adam and Chava? If you eat from the tree, you're going to be like God, to know between good and evil. Well, if they didn't have knowledge of good and evil before then, and we're saying that to be like God means to have this knowledge, it sure sounds like the snake had a good point. So that's a really great question, Andrew. And I am not going to answer it for now because I hope to get to it later. But I will shortly say that you'll either have to say that knowledge of good and evil doesn't mean that doesn't mean what you think it means, and that Tov and Ra doesn't mean knowing what's right and what's wrong, quote unquote, but it means something else. Or you'll say that it doesn't really relate to knowledge at all, but we'll have to get to that in a later point. But it's a great question. It's the right question to ask, frankly. So thanks for that question. Okay, but what do we think about this intellectual? Any does anyone have any problems? Let me ask it that way. Does anyone bother with the notion that Tzemlokim means intellect, means thinking? So I'll tell you, I was bothered by it. Because to me, it doesn't really justify how much you emphasize this notion. You mean to tell me the reason I can't kill a person is because they think or they can acquire knowledge? Well, I think that's great, but like to me, that's not the number one argument I would mention when saying that humans are special and valuable and you can't kill them because they have knowledge. Seems very strange to say something like that. Isn't there more to a human being than intellectual achievement? Isn't there more than a person than simply the knowledge they can acquire when they don't acquire it? And it's also, I think, a bit, it doesn't really explain Selam Elokim, Zemut Elokim, the Rambam says they both mean the same thing, really. They both mean this intellectual capacity. But why they're two different things? And it doesn't seem so godlike, frankly. I mean, like, okay, we can think. It's great. I'm all for thinking, by the way. Let me be clear about that. I don't mean to take away from the importance of using our minds appropriately. But does that really give us a certain godliness to us? Does that mean we're like God because we can think? It's, in a sense, I get it. So I don't think it's the whole story. That's what I'd like to say. So let's move on a bit. And the last point I'll make is, to me, someone who's only a thinker and just, you know, unless you relate that thought to action in the real world, is lacking. So the Rambam would tell me the whole purpose of humans is to think and know and analyze and acquire knowledge of science and philosophy and God and the spiritual sciences and the physical sciences, which the Rambam talks at length about. But isn't there more to human activity than simply knowing and thinking? To me, there is. So let's continue studying this. Okay, I'm gonna go back to my slideshow. Okay, so let's move to another idea. So the next main idea is similar, but a bit different. It's another idea Paul raised before, and that is that it's the question of morality, or what we would call free choice, right? That what's special about humans is that we can make decisions. We can make informed moral decisions. We can chart a path out for our lives. So it's not just for the fact that we can know things, but we can use and apply that knowledge to the way we live life. And to use it to make important decisions. This is what Meir Simcha Advince, how he defines here in this slide, the concept of Tzelem Elokim, right? Take a look here. And I know, Paul, I know you're always intrigued by the problem of free will, of how can we have free will if God has divine foreknowledge. So I want to get to, I'm not going to totally get to that now, but I'll at least give you a quote here where he at least someone addresses it. But it's not going to be satisfactory. Well, let's see what he says. Nase adam b'tzalminu. Hatzalem eloki hu abechira chavshit. Elit hava machria. What does it mean that we're created in, quote-unquote, the form of God, I'm going to say? Not tzalem, but form, but not image, because it's not something physical, but it's a similarity, a likeness to God. Hu abechira chavshit elit hava machria. It means free choice without any compelling compulsion of nature. Only from will, free intellect and free will. Now that's quite a statement, by the way, because I can argue that while we ultimately make the final decision as to what we do and don't do, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's no compulsion. I think most of us do sort of have certain forces that weigh down upon our decision-making. We have to combat them or discern between them. But that's what he's saying here. We have free choice. He says God's knowledge doesn't compel our choice. We don't know how. He has this notion that God's knowledge, it's the Rambam's notion that God's knowledge differs from human knowledge. It's not something apart from God. God has a different type of knowledge. And therefore, that type of knowledge doesn't force our will. It doesn't mean things have to happen. He says we don't understand what that means, because if we would understand it, we would be God, and you could never be God, so you're not going to understand God. That God, as it were, constricted himself in order to give us space to make free choices. That God left a space for his creations to do what they choose. Therefore, he says to himself, I know Dai was very intrigued by this before, so the way Meshech Chachmah has it is he's talking to himself, quote unquote. He's thinking out loud. We should leave a place for men that they shouldn't be compelled in their actions or in their thoughts. And they can do good or evil as they choose, as they desire. They can make decisions against their nature, and they can also make decisions against God's will. That's what Tzelem Elokim means. Again, as a word, God has the choice to the will to either make things exist, to not make them exist, to do as he pleases, and so do humans. So it emerges, it's a transition from simply the realm of intellect to what we do with the intellect. And that's why I think the main difference here. The Sforno here has I like his dichotomy. He relates these two notions to Tzelem Elokim and Dmut Elokim. They're two different things. Whereby Tzelem Elokim, that's the intellect. Sorry about that. That the intellect is Tzelem Elokim. B'tzalmenu etzem sichli mitzchi. Right? That's our soul. It's an internal intellectual form. That's Tzelem Elokim. Dmutenu is our actions. And he goes on to describe the fact that we choose. In fact, the Sforno has a notion that it's kidmutenu, like our image, but not fully. In that, in Sforno's imagination, a conception, it's God talking to the angels, and that our actions are akin to the angels, and that we are aware of what we're doing, but angels, he claims, don't have free will. And we're like somewhere between angels and God, because Hashem also has will, but he never makes the wrong decision.
But Rabbi, are those that choose evil,
yes,
terrible evil, are they still made in God's image?
So that's a great point. Yes. And that's, I think, the difference sort of between the Rambam. So the Rambam says humans are made with this ability to think. But he sort of says it's up to you whether you're B'Tselem Elokim in a sense. You can't fully realize your B'Tselem unless you actually acquire knowledge. For the Sforno, I would say that free choice means you can choose between good and evil. It's a potential. It doesn't necessarily mean you choose correctly. That's the whole point. It means that you can do what you choose to do. And the very Tzelem isn't only positive. It's power. The power can be used for good or for evil. So even I think, you have Tzelem Elokim. You might just misuse it.
Even though there are those who spilled 6 million people's blood.
They were creating the image of God, and they totally misused it. Right? That's what you would say. Tzelem Elokim means you have the power to choose. You can choose evil. And that's what they did. And that was bad. Very bad. Obviously. Again, all of these things, humans were created with incredible capabilities, but they might totally mess up. That's the story of the Torah, right? That's why God... I would argue the story of Adam and Eve and Adam and Chava and Noah and the Teva is the story of humans not appropriately using a Tzelem Elokim, right? It's using it inappropriately. It's not realizing the full potential of what it means to be created with Tzelem Elokim. That's the story of Bereshit. But the Torah sets the backdrop of we're created with the potential of Tzelem Elokim, but we may misuse it. And that's up to us. That's the message of Bereshit. I think, a little bit further than this, it's a bit different, but I think it's along the same lines, is this idea of Mitam Eliyahu. I think it's very beautiful, which is that it's not just that we have free choice, but it's also that we have the ability to be altruistic, that we have the power, we have a certain divine quality whereby we have a tendency to be giving, to be benevolent, to put others before ourselves, to act in a moral way. And that's the Tzelem Elokim. Moving from the realm of the intellect to the realm of activity. That's the Rav Eliyahu Dessler, prominent thinker in the 20th century, argues here. He says, Kasher bara Elokim et ha'adam, asahu l'notein v'notel. When Hashem created man, he made him a giver and a taker. Koach ha'netinahu koach elyon mimidot yotzer ha'kel baruch hu. The ability for us to give, the ability to selflessly give to others, is a divine power. Zumarachim mitiv notein, that God gives. God has mercy. God is the ultimate giver, the ultimate altruistic being. Meblila kabal davar tmira. God gives and gets nothing in return. Bekacha asa et ha'adam. Hakatu b'tzelem elokim asa et ha'adam. Ki yuchal rachem v'litim. What does it mean that we're created in the image of God? It means that we can give, that we can be altruistic, that we can be benevolent, that we can give without the need to receive. Now, back to my point here, I think you see two totally different poles of human perfection. Whereas the Rambam would argue the perfect human being is someone who has mastered all knowledge, but Dessler would argue that the perfect human being is someone who is totally altruistic, who has mastered their character, who has gone to the point where they're willing to give and to love and to be merciful, and they make all the right moral decisions. That's Tzelem Elokim. I think it's very beautiful in that it's this parallelism. God is the ultimate, you know, giver, in the sense that he didn't need anything and created everything. And humans, in that vein, are also in the image of God. And I think here, I always felt, you know, when we talk about the notion of sensing God in the world and sort of arguments for the existence of God, and this is not foolproof, but I always felt that one of the most powerful ones is morality, and that I think we do sense a certain innate tendency to want to be good, to want to be considerate, to want to help people, to want to help the other. And it's really fascinating. Where does that come from? Now, there are scientific reasons for it, but in terms of our desire to continue wanting to be that way, that we feel that we'd be letting ourselves down if we didn't give, if we weren't considerate, is a very powerful notion for the spiritual quality God put in us. And that's what Dessler argues here, that we have to look at ourselves and see our own qualities as parallel to those that God uses to run the world. And he put them in us in order for us to be like him. That we have to, that by being in tune with our nature, our kohod, our powers, our capability to be good and benevolent and merciful, we can in a sense be like God, because he put godlike qualities within us. So that's a second approach here. Tzelem Elokim isn't as much about thinking, is much more about doing, about making the right choice, being benevolent, being good people, being altruistic. Okay, so let's stop. So any thoughts about that? No, I would wonder, do you prefer Rav Dessler's approach or the Rambam's approach? Like, what do you think makes more sense in terms of the context of Tzelem Elokim being the valley of humans, or in terms of Tzelem Elokim being godlike? Are you more comfortable with Rav Dessler or the Rambam? I'm just curious.
I think that the Rambam's approach fits better with Pshat, because when it connects it to Uruduvit Gatayam, and that has nothing to do with choices.
Right. Right, so Chaim points out that in one sense, the fact that the connection is that we rule over the other animals and the other creatures does seem to lend to an intellect. I would argue back that I think that the notion that humans, you can't kill a human being because they're made with Tzelem Elokim, I think may relate better to Rav Dessler's point. Because the point is that humans have the capability to do really wonderful things. They can, humans can love and they provide for so much. So how could you kill them? But I would argue that, I think to me, both of these come up short in a sense. I think that even saying that humans make good decisions, that we have free will, free choice, number one, I think Paul's point is a good one because people don't always make the right choice, right? So what if I find someone, say, who is a horrible person and they're not benevolent or altruistic and they're not using their capabilities to be godlike and they make all sorts of bad decisions in their life? Does that mean that they don't have Tzelem Elokim or their value? They don't have that existential value where they're not using their intellect. That's number one. One reason. I think when we think about what you think about the fundamental question, what makes a human valuable? Why do I have to respect other human beings and respect what they want, even if it's not what I want? I think we don't necessarily immediately think of the fact, oh, because they can make good decisions. I think there's something more fundamental to it. Number two, I think Chazal, if you look the way the sages look at Tzelem Elokim, it seems like it's something more that simply we have the capability to make informed decisions. Because there's this, if looking at Chazal, there's an incredible affinity and preciousness with which they view the concept of Tzelem Elokim. Take a look at the mission of them. Huay Omer, Rabbi Kiva said, Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem. Man is precious or beloved because they are created in the image or form. Chiba Yotera no Dalo, right? Abundant love was made known to man. God made us aware of his abundant love for us by telling us that he created us in his image. Shenemar ki b'tzelem Elokim asah et ha'adam, right? Because it says that God made man in his image. This notion that this is an expression of God's abundant love, chavivut, to me sounds like it's something a little bit more than the fact that we can be good people. Of course, that's valuable, but the emphasis we put on it. Furthermore, take a look at this midrash. So it's actually very beautiful. This midrash in the Mechilta Rabbi Yishmael points out something remarkable, which is that if you look at the Ten Commandments, we think of them sometimes as sort of a set of ten. But we can also think of them as two sets of five, because on one side is quote-unquote, let's say, the side of man and man's relationship to God and parents. And the other side is man to his fellow friend, right? The Medrash does here is it connects them. It says you can connect 1 and 5, 2 and 6, 3 and 7, 4 and 8, 3 and 8, 4 and 9, 5 and 10. So for instance, I'll give you an example. It says that you can't worship idols. This is not the one we're going to read in a second. It also says you can't commit adultery. Why would idols be parallel to adultery? What would the connection be between worshiping foreign entities and essentially betraying one's marriage? Well, they're both a betrayal of a relationship. So there's a parallelism. You have a relationship with God. To serve another God is a betrayal. We have relationships with our spouse to have an affair would be a betrayal. So there's a parallelism there. So the first one, though, is a parallelism between Anochi Hashem Lokecha, the mandate to acknowledge God's existence, and Lo Tirtzach, don't murder. And take a look at the Midrash says here. Ketzad Natnu Aseret HaDibrot, Ha'alu Aseh Ve'alu Aseh. The Aseret HaDibrot were given such that there was five on one side, five on the other. Ketiv Anochi Hashem Lokecha. It says, I am Hashem your God. Ukeneg Lo Tirtzach. Corresponding to that is the commandment not to kill. Magid HaKatuv Shekol Mi Sheshofek Dam Ma'ale Alav HaKatuv Ki'ilu Mima'et Bidmut HaMelech. That anyone who kills, who sheds blood, it's as if they had diminished the image, the likeness of the king. that by killing another human being, you're minimizing God's likeness. There's quote unquote less God in the world. That's what it sounds like. Mashallah, and it gives a parable. Mashallah, masmalak basar vadam shen nichnas lemedina. There's a parable to a king of flesh and blood who enters into a country. Vehemelo ikonot. He makes icons of himself. Aslo tzlamim. He makes statues. Vetavulo matbaon. He makes stamps. His signet. La'achar zman kifkapelo ikonotav shavelo tzlamal vitlo matbaotav v'mibjo shamela. What happens? Afterward, they knock down the statues of the king. They get rid of the pictures of the king. They break. They remove all the seals. And that diminishes the king's image in the country. He has less of there's less respect, less of a presence in the country. He has less of a hold over his country. Anyone who spills blood, that the humans are the signet rings and the stamps and the pictures and the icons, which are representative of God. Shenemar shofech adam ba'adam, damo yishofech, ki betzam lo himasat adam. Now that, to me, is an incredible idea. And to me, it says that there's a greater connection between humans and God than simply the fact that we can think. I don't think, it's hard for me to, or even make decisions, it's hard for me to grasp the fact that because we can make decisions, that when a human is killed, God's presence in the world is diminished. Just by virtue of the fact that we can make decisions.
Aren't there provisions in the Torah where the penalty is death?
This is a good question. It's a fair question. So why should there be a death penalty? Apparently, I think it sort of relates to your point before, but apparently there are times where we had to be mimai mutol shamela. I don't think anyone says that that's a happy thing. But you're right. It's 100% true. I guess the other counterpoint would be that it would have to be that those prohibitions, those violations are a greater chilul Hashem, you know, so drastically violate the person's tzelem Elokim that they have defiled their godliness to such a point that it's worth doing this horrific act, which of normally, you know, diminishing God's presence in the world. But you're making
blood. It's still spilling the blood.
What did you say?
It's still spilling the blood.
Yes, it's a tragedy. It's a horrible tragedy. There's no doubt about it. No one is happy with the death penalty. It just might be sometimes worth it. You know, I think you could, for, you know, we could think of different reasons why it might be worth it, but it's certainly a tragedy. There's no doubt about that.
Does say in lo damim as if he doesn't have blood, as if the act of death penalty.
Right, you have times where in lo damim as if, like, you know, for instance, I think, you know, a classic example would be someone who's going to kill someone else, which is a case where we say in lo damim, and they've forfeited in a sense their tzelem Elokim. That's what you could argue. Once they're going to do that, when you decide that you're going to end someone else's life and take away their tzelem Elokim, then you betrayed your godly nature. But to me, this speaks to something greater than simply the fact that man is created in the image of God. So I think there's more to it, and I'm not going to get to all of it now, but let me at least leave you with
Sammy, can I ask
one more point? Yeah, Mark, you can make a quick point.
In terms of the passage that you were just referring to, it seems like when the Israelites entered the land, it must have been somewhat of a solemn circumstance, because if man is made in the image of God, there was a lot of blood spilled to conquer that land. And you would wonder why that would occur if this is the promised land. Why couldn't it have been done some other way? And wouldn't that in itself diminish the conquering of the land? And the settlement of the land.
Yeah. Your point is certainly similar to the Paul's point. You know, we have to look into that specific instance of you know, Andrew refers to the war that the Jewish people had to fight with the land of Israel. I certainly don't think that that, you know, especially according to those opinions who argue that the Jews offered, sent letters offering them the opportunity to make peace before they did it. I certainly don't think that the killing is something that they celebrated. It's certainly a tragedy. You know, and it's certainly a tragedy that those people warranted such a punishment. It's certainly a tragedy. I don't think I would deny that. I think the point you're all both making, you and Paul, is that just because a person is made B'Tselem Elokim, that killing someone is a horrific tragedy, doesn't mean that there's never a reason to do it. There might be a reason to do it. It's just a horrific tragedy. You know, the one reason might be to, you know, I would say two reasons, just fundamentally, either because it's saving other people, and if you let them live, there will be more Tselem Elokim or Tzemut Elokim lost in the world, or on a spiritual level, right? That if we're created for a purpose and we're supposed to use our Tselem Elokim to make the world a place that's more, has more quote unquote godliness in it, if people are just sabotaging that mission, that might be where God says so, would be another general reason. But you're right, I think it's a tragedy. Let me just leave you with this last point, and then maybe we'll get to the two other ideas that Tselem Elokim last time, because I want to take 1 minute or 2 seconds just to do our little Genesis Journeys clip. So Rabbi Mechai ben Asher makes the following point, and this relates to the Naaseh. We say not, the Torah says, we shall make man. Who's we? So as I said, there are a few different interpretations. One is that God's talking to the angels. And in fact, there are some who argue that when we say we're made in the image of Elohim, it doesn't refer to God, actually. It refers to the angels. Because Elohim doesn't always mean God. It can mean any, like, it can even mean a judge. Sometimes it means a nobility. It means a higher creature. But Rabbeinu Bahaye here is quoting the Ramban and Rabbeinu Delakimchi with another explanation, which is as follows. Dmut and Tselem are diametrically opposed. And Dmut, Dmutenu, the Dmut of Adam, the physical image of a man, is not like God at all. In fact, it's like the earth. It's purely, it's physical. It's material. And the Tselem is the spiritual element of man. That's the soul. And when God says, let us make man, he's talking to the earth, as it were, and he's saying, you are going to contribute the material for the body of humans, the raw material, and I'll contribute the soul. So that it's, there's this sort of dichotomy. There's two poles of man, and we're both physical and spiritual at the same time. And that's the idea of Tselem Elokim and Dmut Elokim. So with that, I leave you with the question, if that's so, then what do we, when we talk about, when we emphasize that humans are created in B'Tselem and Dmut Elokim, if it's true that it's both with a physical body and physical existence and a spiritual existence, what does that say about the existential value of humans? There's something about the fact that it's not just that we have an intellect or we can make free choice, but that we're also physical beings with, who are made, quote-unquote, with bodies that resemble the land or raw material. And if we hearken back to what we saw with Barbanel, that we're made on the same day as the animals were made, that in a sense, we're not totally above nature, as we discussed. What does that say about the value of humans and their uniqueness? So with that, we'll close for now. We'll continue with the rest of this topic next time, and hopefully begin the story about a Mechava. So I'm going to stop this recording. If you have just 1 minute to humor me,